This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, and streaming live at freakradio.org. That's F-R-E-A-K radio.org, freakradio.org. Go to our website to listen online. Click on the listen link and follow the instructions there. Make sure your speakers are turned up and plugged in. Or simply click on the red oval you see there on our main page. It's 3:01 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. Monday, August 3rd, 2015. My name is Lawrence Tuwil. You can call me Ren. As in R-E-N, I am your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American. For over 3 years now, delivering my take, my slant, my sentiment on the Israeli-Palestinian and Israeli-other Arab conflict. I need to talk to you a little bit about something really, really important, because it has to do with, you guessed it, I'm sure, with the continuation of Free Radio in Santa Cruz. FRSC is probably the longest-running, unlicensed, non-compliant with the Federal Communications Commission pirate radio service in the history of the free world, at least in relatively recent times. We've been doing this, we're in our 20th year now. We've been basically continuously on the air, but for one, maybe more than one, major interruption when we were taken down by the feds, by the FCC, in 2004. The service began in 1995, liberating the airwaves since then, we have been, and not going through the formal and extremely expensive process of being licensed and totally compliant with the FCC. We prefer to go the pirate underground, most basic grassroots community radio effort, not just to save money. It's not something you just throw over your head and turn on overnight either. It takes some doing and some collective and individual expense, but the whole idea of foregoing licensure through the feds is so that we can maintain a service which is not hindered by the government nor by the government's corporate puppet masters. Our editorial stance, the kinds of things we play concerning the community, local topics, issues, politics, it's easier and freer for us to discuss them most honestly without corporately influenced governmental influence and pressure. We want to be free of corporate influence. That's basically what we're getting at. Okay, so here we are, Free Radio Santa Cruz, in our 20th year, the only free radio operation, at least on the FM or AM dials, in Santa Cruz County. You know, a few weeks ago, I and three other upstanding current members of the Free Radio Collective were interviewed, we kind of interviewed ourselves, on CTV, Community Television, and the an initial wave of showings, six showings of that half-hour-long program, almost a half hour, completed a week or two ago on Channel 27 on the Comcast spectrum where I live in the county anyway. Channel 27 generally is CTV's community access and information station there. They have three or more channels that they have. Also have arts programming, a calendar, that kind of thing. Free radio actually operates completely independent of and from community TV. We are not the same outfit, I repeat. Free Radio Santa Cruz is not by any means connected directly and in only the most casual sense by people knowing people. It could be said that we're friendly with CTV here, but it's not the same outfit, and we don't have the same bosses behind either operation. But Brian Schulman, longtime producer at CTV, put together the interview of the free radio folks, some of us, and although it the initial showing of those six the showings of the same interview is over and done with. I'm sure they have it in their library. Keep it there for a while anyway. They may show them again. But the important thing is you can go see it on YouTube if you missed it. Go to YouTube. Simply plug in BTS Presents Free Radio Santa Cruz. B as in boy, T as in Tawil. Me, T-A-W-I-L. S as in Shulman. BTS Presents Free Radio Santa Cruz on YouTube, and you too, at no cost or great hassle, can see that 28-minute long show. Like so many other things, it ends up on YouTube. So that's just to give you an idea of, after 20 years of service, the interest that there is amongst a community TV producer anyway, producer, director, and of what we do here, we have every intention and desire to continue the operation. And now, as I kind of think some of you are sensing, we're getting into the bad news. I repeat, we have every intention to continue free radio in Santa Cruz County, and we certainly are desirous of it. As of October 1st of this year, Free Radio Studio will have to give up its lease on the studio space. As of October 1st, in about 2 months, we are going to be out of here. Notice was served just yesterday, in fact, formally. We were informed of the situation. The property where the studio is located itself is under radical reassessment, reconfiguration, and they're going to be most likely knocking down walls big time and doing some reconstruction of the physical property, the actual real estate here. Well, the building is on the real estate. So they're in the throes of their own growth pains, as it were, themselves. And unfortunately, looks like Free Radio is going to have to find a new home in terms of the studio. This is a separate issue from the transmitter for our radio service. Which is still up and running and broadcasting on traditional, old-fashioned, normal radio airwaves and plugging away 24/7, just as is our streaming service, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on the computer, in cyberspace. So that is the most... at this point in time, it is the one critical, immediate concern we have, is all the effort and the thought and the planning that's going to have to be put into finding a new home for Free Radio Santa Cruz. We've got 2 months, just a hair less than 2 months, and I'm letting everyone know about this, first of all. Of course, just because we have to move out doesn't mean you have to move out of your homes and places. You basically don't have to do anything. I do want to assure everyone, yet again, that we are looking forward to Free Radio's continuous operation. Past the losing of our lease date of October 1st, there is the possibility that, at least for a short time, we will only be able to continue broadcasting recorded, canned, and otherwise imported radio shows. Free Radio wants to make this wonderful material from folks like KPFA and KPFK out of Berkeley, out of Houston, etc. Wants to continue to make those available to you, in addition to our own locally produced stuff by our own Santa Cruz County producers, including myself. I am Rent Wheel, and actually, this is the Mideast Migraines program. I don't think I... here it is, 12 minutes past the hour, and I'm finally telling you, yes, this is Mideast Migraines, and this is the situation that I'm letting you in on. So as I was saying, to begin with, you obviously don't have to do anything apart from your normal activities, but if you want to continue to be able to listen to us and be able to brag about the fact that you are a part of Free Radio Santa Cruz on the receiving end, if not the interactive end, and if you want to be able to know that you can continue to promote this program informally on your own to your friends and families, then you might want to think about a few things here. And you're going to be hearing about this, hopefully, with every live production from this point on until we're forced to discontinue operation from this physical location. You can think about any ideas you have for a new location for the studio. The first and foremost important item is the fact that, as I finished describing to you a little bit ago, we are a pirate station. This is an illegal operation. We're not compliant with the FCC. We refuse to be licensed and go through that process. There are some other rather enlightened individuals across the country who have founded left-leaning, liberal, commie pinko, perhaps, but generally left-leaning, smart, progressive, broadcasting on the airwaves, both radio and television. And some 40 years ago, I had a little bit to do, for example, just one example, with the founding of KFAI, Minneapolis FM radio station. I haven't even kept up with them. I don't even know if they're still going or not. But that was not a pirate station. They actually went through the whole process. As again, this was some 40 years ago in the late 1970s. The process of becoming licensed, legitimate, across the board. And they, as I recall, they did some really excellent work. In fact, the people who were so dedicated and so into pulling off a full-fledged, legit FM radio station did such a fine job of making their presentation to the FCC, including all the diagrams and technical specs and blueprints and everything, that the people who to whom the KFAI founders addressed that to in the government came right out and said, we have never, ever seen such spectacularly professional and precise work plans plans and presentation. Presentation is not the best word. Proposal for a new station. So this just says something about what the people can do when the people are really into it. But again, that was a licensed station, and that has to do with the world of American radio some 40 years ago, late 1970s. And I ended up, a colleague of mine ended up doing his own world music show, good old Cliff Sloan. Wonder what he's up to lately. Ended up hosting tours to China, from what I understand. At any rate, Cliff interviewed me for one program because I was very much into my folk, international folk dance and international folk dance music, playing my records, my vinyl records, on the station. But that was the limit of my activity. But again, just I'm trying to be somewhat inspirational and boasting what the people can do when they really want to. Of course, now for an unlicensed pirate radio operation, it's quite a different story. The upside is that we don't have all the legal hoops that we have to jump through in order to pretty much keep it going on a daily basis. And then from there, it's kind of downhill. I mean, the downside from that point is that given the immediate crisis, we're asking you, the listener, the follower of this wonderful operation, to do a little bit of get into thinking cap territory there, do some brainstorming either on your own or with others about where we can possibly move to. We have been on the very general lookout for a new location, and you know, once in a while we get some activity up there. Someone gets a little bit of inspiration, and it looks like we may be able to move either the studio or the transmitter to such and such a place, and then it doesn't pan out. Of course, what I'm getting to and was getting to a few moments ago was that this being a non-licensed operation, we need to find someone who, you know, we're not going to try to fool anyone. The person that we're going to be dealing with who owns the property and the potential new studio will be fully aware that we're not licensed, and quite frankly, there is a legal risk to anyone who offers such a space that we can use. We do indeed. It's not impossible, obviously. As I said, this is a 20-year-long operation. We've been doing this with only one, having been raided by the feds, and that was 11 years ago, the last one and only time that they raided the place, and within a few weeks we were back on the air again. The community came out in support and raised all kinds of funds for Free Radio Santa Cruz, and our very own, the city council for the city of Santa Cruz, on more than one occasion came out and supported Free Radio. And whether or not the mayor and the council members, it was Scott Kennedy early on, during the time of the raid in 2004, who came out and lashed back at the FCC for raiding us with their in-house cops, mainly due to the fact that the state of the world and the state of the country being what it was at the time. We were in Iraq. We had just invaded the country the year before, and we were still very much involved in Afghanistan militarily, as we still are. We're even militarily involved in Iraq and becoming more so again. And a lot of other things that probably got these city council people to thinking about the value of real community radio and our ability to get the alternative news and perspective out. So they came to our rescue, at least in terms of moral support. And then in 2010, the city of Santa Cruz made a proclamation, a formal documented proclamation in praise and in favor of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We've got it hanging right up here on the wall. As a matter of fact, I can't seem to remove it. Obviously something I could have thought about before I began the show today. Someone apparently took some initiative and was foreseeing enough to know that we'd better lock that proclamation in place. So it's stuck up there on the wall. So I can't get it down, and I won't be able to. Extend the microphone over, but it is an official proclamation from the City Council of Santa Cruz. Mike Rotkin was mayor at the time. This was in 2010, I think. And it was a mayor's proclamation declaring their support for the operation, knowing full well that it was illegitimate usurpation of the airwaves by unlicensed pirates. That's why we call ourselves Pirate Radio. Big deal. Point is, we're known about, we're supported from on high, from certain locations on high, as it were. One of the few times that I suppose that City Council has done something of such wide acceptance and praise from the community. People continue to have their problems with the current mayor and the current council and all kinds of things having to do with various issues, homelessness in the city, whether or not it's okay to walk your dog on property belonging to the campus, University of California campus, etc., and people find various reasons to get upset about things. Highways going back to the more quote-unquote innocent days of this country and of California, paradise on the West Coast here, paradise on the Pacific, the kinds of things that people tended to get really talking about were more roads, wider roads, and improving the commute, not so much in terms of transit, certainly not in terms of rail transportation, but making it easier to get to and from work in your one person occupying private vehicle. I feel like I'm beginning to drift a little bit here. Okay, but the thing is, free radio has enormous value to this community. You're not likely to hear about it, if ever at all, through any avenue of mainstream media or mainstream print news broadcasting. Free radio is ignored as much as possible by the so-called legitimate broadcasters on both radio and television and in the print. Once in a great while, I think the Sentinel did do an article, at least one article on us 10 or 15 years ago. I was not involved at the time, but we've been here for 20 years, and you will not hear much about us through pretty, through those avenues or any other avenues, primarily because we obviously have no budget, zero budget for advertising and getting the word out about this service, other than through word of mouth, other than through you, the listener. And it's you, the listeners, that we are appealing to, and you're going to hear this message more and more. Frankly, I expect that the message will get in the way of the kind of music, talk, and news, and other wonderful stuff, including in-house, locally produced electronic music every Friday night. Until we are due to be off of the premises, October 1st, and make no confusion here. We're just talking about the need for us to be out of this building by October 1st. This is not the end of free radio by any means. This is not the end of FRSC. This is not the end of our transmissions. But in 2 months' time, it'll take a new form. And, of course, we do not know what exactly that form will be. And we certainly don't know where we're going to be physically ourselves, where we're going to be producing this operation from. We need advice. We need offers. We need some brilliant ideas from you, the listener. We're not dumping the whole thing on your lap. We obviously, the members of the Radio Collective here, are doing what we can on our end. But anything that we do ultimately is going to interact with a supportive community out there who may be willing to take risks or simply see this as a kind of business proposition. It'll be nothing that anyone will be able to make any money on. That's absolutely out of the question. We're not talking about monetary enticements, but we are talking about people who really love the idea of free radio and the kinds of things you hear on this station, and lo and behold, if you want to continue to hear from me, the Mideast Migraines program about Palestine and Israel and all that good stuff, please take advantage of this opportunity to buckle down and think really hard and come up with some ideas. It'll be frustrating because I'm sure a lot of the ideas that people might be mulling around in their brains are ideas that we have talked about ourselves more than once, several times over. In fact, we get new members of the collective once in a great while who get really excited about something, and lo and behold, they mention it and they say, yeah, we thought about that. And that's not a lot of fun. It's not encouraging when you get shouted down, not literally shouted down, but just reminded of the fact that there are some there are categories of things that can be done to deal with this problem. One quick example is, do we want to be in an actual solid real estate position when we are where we are in-house again with a roof consistently over our heads and broadcasting out of a studio per se, or do we want to operate out of some kind of a vehicle, a van, an old RV, something with two or three axles? Would that be advantageous? Is it realistic? Can we stay hooked up in terms of actual hardware to not only a constant supply of electrical power, but will we be able to stay continuously and connecting to our transmitter, our antenna, so that we can put the show out over the air? That's what makes us a pirate station from a technical viewpoint. Erecting a transmitter without the help of the feds, completely bypassing permission by various governmental authorities, and simply pirating our service out. We could, as is the case with a number of radio services, radio being a kind of old-school wording, over the Internet. There are many radio stations, networks, Probably the most recent famous one that's just come online is Dark Matter Digital Radio Network. I don't want to plug for them, but this just to give you, if you've heard of it, Dark Matter Digital is a obviously legitimate, to some degree licensed activity, but it's strictly a cyberspace operation. Radio on the net that you receive on your devices, your computers, your handheld devices, etc. The signal may be picked up on shortwave in some instances, and possibly through AM and FM at others. I haven't even checked the situation locally, but that just came on about 2 weeks ago. So there are, but the thing is, radio service over the net is not, in the strictest sense, a pirate operation because of the inherent lack of licensing procedures and those requirements to simply be on the internet. And I'm contradicting myself here because I talked about possible licensure things that Dark Matter had to do in order to get on the air. But I think for other reasons, they had to do things through appropriate legal channels. But for this, for Free Radio Santa Cruz to maintain our status, our stature, and our reputation as being a pirate service, we do need a studio in some way, shape, or form in order to keep this service up and to broadcast through the airwaves. I can't make a vibrato sound like some of my friends can, whistling and humming at the same time. Yeah. But that's what that is, folks. That's the situation with Free Radio Santa Cruz in terms of what you'll be hearing, just the way you've been used to hearing it for two decades now. You'll just keep on tuning in to 101.3 FM or going to freakradio.org. Go to freakradio.org and closely examine our website. There's not that much to it. Frankly, we're still a bit behind in updating certain things, but just get an idea of how we operate, what we need to do and to make available to you on our website to maintain some interoperability with the listening community. And also note that there is an address for you to submit donations to the service. We're always asking for donations anyway because we cannot accept any corporate contributions or sponsorships. That's written into our own bylaws. That's how serious we are about this ongoing act of civil disobedience by not going through the FCC. We cannot and do not accept corporate contributions, and just saying that alone almost kind of slams the listener up against a brick wall, knowing that we cannot accept monies from big daddies, big sugar daddies. The immediate question comes to mind, well, how the hell do we keep this service up and going without that kind of support? It's us, the programmers, who pay dues on a regular basis, and it's you, the listeners, that we need to ask for donations from. So go to our website, see the address to which you can send your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz, see the address. You can also send inquiries and an application that you can download from said website if you want to have your own program here on Free Radio. You can do that too also, and submit an application if you're interested. But I don't want to say but. You can do all that stuff, and now we've given you some other another wonderful, challenging, to be fully embraced opportunity to save our asses. We must go to our listening community, those we serve, those we hear from, we need an offer of property. Here is the basic requirements that we have. We must, of course, for a 24/7 operation, have 24-hour-a-day 7 days a week, 365 1/4 days a year, or something like that. Access to this studio. We must be able to get in at any time of day. Not that there is a lot of 2-3 a.m. in the morning activity. That's actually almost unheard of. In the recent history, anyway, but we need to be able to get to the studio at a moment's notice, usually for unexpected activities. Roughly between midnight and 7:30 a.m., we run canned programs. Anyway, we simply run a stream of about 7.5 hours of pre-recorded shows, so generally people don't have to, but if we need to get into the studio, must be 24-hour access at any time in the course of a year. Consistent electrical power, of course. We require a bathroom, just to be realistic about this on a human level. We would prefer minimum problems with parking. That is, that request has taken the form of, what was it? No parking tax, whatever that meant. That's what it said on the original requisition for in our request for a new studio space. We have been interested in a new studio space for some time, mainly because we pay too damn much for in American dollars. For this space, it has served us well, but it's not perfect, and we would like to be able to avoid spending more than $300, hopefully less, $300 a month for a studio space. So, 24-hour access, a secure location, secure meaning in terms of ability to lock a good solid wooden door. When no one is in here, bathroom, warm, dry. Warm these days is not much of a challenge, but at least dry with all the electrical components and all that. Ability to keep a stream of power running and our transmission running out of here. All you one who has such a place that they may be able to let us use have to be concerned with is the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week access, bathroom, relatively clean and dry. And that's pretty much it in terms of our requirements for the property, the new property, which we're going to need, by the looks of things, in about 2 months, starting in 2 months. That is the latest crisis from the latest piece of news from Free Radio Santa Cruz, and again, you're going to be hearing about this more and more. So, one way of looking at this is the sooner someone comes up with an answer to our request and our beseechment, something that pans out. The minute we know we have something that looks like it's going to work, then we can stop making these announcements. But you'll continue to hear more and more of this announcement from behind this microphone. You'll probably be hearing about it in the community, out there in the community as well, whether or not you are a worker or a patron of Sub Rosa. What's the name of that place? India Joe's? Any of the other hangouts that some of our people are used to having things to do with? Prominent members of the community who have had connections with Free Radio, maybe even have had or currently has a program at the time. You'll be hearing more about this. I hope the hell people will be hearing more about this. And please don't let it go into one ear and pass out the other. We need community involvement, interactivity, interoperability. That is the state of affairs at FRSC. Okay. I have spent 2/3 of an hour talking about this now. It's 3:40 p.m. Pacific time. How about, just in order, I need to see how many people I put to sleep here. Wait a minute. Okay, actually gained one listener on the mono line, lost one on the stereo line. But the thing is, thank you so much to those who are listening, along with all my other Mideast Migraines programs. This one is going to be made available for podcasting as soon as I get it up on radioforall.net. That's another alternative website, radio4, ALL.net, radioforall.net. And you can have all these boring details repeated into your ear again, or get the word out to the rest of the world by making more intelligent, proper use of that podcast. All right. What do I have for you regarding, until another thing about this whole crisis, and admittedly it is a crisis as it's felt by each of us to some degree, with 2 months' notice, it's not like we've had a fire or something serious here. I should be careful about using the word fire over the airwaves, but I have to think about the future of this program and my future as radio producer and host and announcer here, given these circumstances. So, given the circumstances, and being a Palestinian-American who wants to get my angle of the truth out to you, I think you're probably going to be hearing, to be sure, more recent news from the region of the Judeo-Christian and Muslim Holy Land, part of it anyway. Not only news, but some really basic stuff here. I made it a point to bring in my copy of Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine. The full name of the book is Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. The book was originally copyrighted in 2005, was it? She makes it so hard to get to the copyright page here. Oh, all these maps and things are in the way. 2000 originally went to print. Copyright 2007 by the author, Anna Balzer. Now, I did read this entire book on the air a few months ago, and those podcasts are available at Radio for All as well. This is one of the greatest books from the Palestinian perspective, again, written by an American Jewish woman, which tends to confuse a lot of people. That's because more and more Jews, both American and around the world, including very much in Israel, more and more Jewish people are taking a closer look at the original promise of Zionism in Palestine and converting that area into the land of Israel, as they see it. And more Jewish people are taking a look at that and saying, hey, is this really what we want? Is it really worth it to uproot a people, another people who are not Jewish, who have lived here for thousands and thousands of years? Putting up this impenetrable, seemingly impenetrable wall between the Jewish people and the non-Jewish people, or the Gentile people, whatever you want to call them, Goyim, whatever. But the thing is, this is one of a great book, not only because it is an excellent translation of her journal entries during her three trips during a period of a few years in the early part of the millennium. Translation of her journal entries into book form, but it has all kinds of wonderful maps, comparative maps, very accurate things, tons and tons of full-color pictures, even reprints of children's artwork, the children who are Palestinian Arab children who are under occupation, and how this has affected their way of looking at things. Glossary here, tons of quotes. I am going to reread actually never even finished. One appendix, there's four or five interesting appendixes or appendices in this book. And one that I began to read to you that I never finished is simply Appendix 4, Myths and Frequently Asked Questions About the Israeli-Arab Conflict, and specifically the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. So, in addition to the news items, the current issues that I'm going to be getting across to you, I'm going to be talking about some real basic things as per this author and that writer, and of course the ones that I want to expose everyone to. So here we go. Again, this is taken from Witness in Palestine by Anna Baltzer, who is a Jew herself. Myths and Frequently Asked Questions. I'll finally have an opportunity to get through all these. So I'm not totally rereading it because the last half of it I never read to you to begin with. Myth number one. This is an ancient war between Jews and Muslims who simply can't get along. That's the myth. Here is her response to that. The Israel-Palestine impasse actually began quite recently. Less than 100 years ago, the Palestinian people living in the area, composed of Muslims and Christians and Jews, were actually coexisting relatively harmoniously. There were certain exceptions, Anna Baltzer writes here, but overall Jews were better treated in the Muslim and Arab world than almost anywhere in the Christian West. Which, of course, is to say Europe and the Americas. She writes, many older Palestinians remember a time before the Nakba, or the great catastrophe ousting the Palestinians in 1948. Older Palestinians remember a time before the Nakba when they lived side by side as neighbors with Jews and their children played together. However, with the imposition of a state favoring the rights of Jews while dispossessing and excluding the non-Jewish indigenous population, has come the emergence of violence. Also, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians worldwide are Christian, and they are subject to the same restrictions as their Muslim counterparts. She mentions Palestinians, Christian Palestinians worldwide, but she's speaking of the restrictions against both Christians and Muslims in Palestine, or in Israel, both Israel itself and the occupied territories. She continues to write here, this is a modern struggle for human rights and equality, not a war of Jews and Muslims. The historic precedent of Muslims, Christians, and Jews coexisting in Palestine can be a hope-inspiring reminder that there is nothing inherently impossible about these populations sharing the land together in the absence of discriminatory structures. Okay? Reading from Anna Baltzer's Myths and Frequently Asked Questions, which she includes in the book Witness in Palestine, an appendix containing listing myths and frequently asked questions. That was myth number one. Myth number one and its response. Myth number two, criticism of Zionism or criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. That's the myth. Her answer, Zionism is distinct from Judaism. In fact, many Jews find Zionism itself antithetical to Jewish principles. There is nothing Jewish about occupation and discrimination. And there is nothing anti-Jewish about speaking out against them. In fact, it is offensive to claim that criticism of human rights abuses is criticism of Judaism, which equates the two. In other words, which falsely equates the two. Myth number three, the Palestinian refugee problem was created when Palestinians fled on radio orders. Very interesting myth here. Radio orders from Arab leaders to move out of the way of an attack. That's the myth. Baltzer's answer, when Zionist and Israeli state and army archives were declassified in the 1980s, the myth that Palestinians left their homes voluntarily in 1948 was refuted by Israeli historians who monitored countless broadcasts and found, and I quote, not a single order or appeal or suggestion about evacuation from Palestine from any Arab radio station inside or outside Palestine in 1948, end quote. I'm going to say that again. A quotation, not a single order or appeal or a suggestion about evacuation from Palestine, from any Arab radio station, inside or outside Palestine in 1948, end quote. Not one single order or appeal was heard, or suggestion about evacuations, non-existent. In fact, Balzer writes, the only Arab orders recorded were for Palestinians to stay put. This, according to Erskine Childers, a British researcher, as quoted in Sami Hadawi, Bitter Harvest, Scorpion Publishing Limited, 1983, as cited in The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, published by Jews for Justice in the Middle East, third edition. To stay put. Independent Midwest scholar and activist Jason Weeks put it nicely, quote, it is ironic that the so-called orders from above theory should enjoy a kind of afterlife in the United States. The Zionist community here is actually rather insulted from the complex public debate about Zionism in Israel. Our U.S. pro-Israel crowd looks a little backward when they keep repeating these myths. They're still digging out the same debating points they used 30 and 40 years ago. They are perhaps more an embarrassment than a help to Israel's cause. That was from personal correspondence from Jason Weeks to the author, November 19, 2006. So much for the radio broadcasts. And people still use that excuse. I hear them trying to convince others that they were instructed, that they were ordered away from their homes and cities, towns, and villages so that they can be saved. It's kind of a backward way of thinking. Myth number four. Listen closely, folks. Myth number four. Israel is a democracy. The myth of Israeli democracy has been consistently refuted by Palestinian, Israeli, and other human rights groups. Israel is the state of the Jewish people, not the state of its citizens. Non-Jewish citizens are excluded from many things granted automatically to Jews. About 93% of the land in Israel is managed by the Israel Lands Administration, an extension of the Jewish National Fund, rendering it either very difficult or outright impossible for non-Jewish Palestinian citizens of Israel to move into it. And one footnote to that statement, most of this land was taken from Palestinians to begin with, who became refugees in 1948, so it was their land to begin with. Balzer continues, many Palestinian citizens of Israel are, quote, internal refugees, prevented from returning to their own villages within Israel, while Jewish Israelis can often freely visit, leave, or purchase that same land. Palestinian citizens of Israel can vote or run for office, but it is within a limited framework. Any candidate running on a platform that Israel should become the state of all of its citizens, not only of the Jewish people, can be disqualified. Footnote to that, Israel's basic law, the Knesset, 1958, states that, quote, a person shall not be a candidate for election to the Knesset, the Knesset is Israel's parliament, if the goals or actions of the list or the actions of the person expressly or by implicated include negation of the existence of the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, end quote. But she goes on to say here, a 1989 high court case challenging the law found that, quote, it is necessary to prevent a Jew or Arab who calls for equality of rights for Arabs from sitting in the Knesset, Israeli parliament, or being elected to it, end quote. I'm going to read that again. The 1989 high court case challenging that law found that it is necessary to prevent a Jew or Arab non-Jewish person, who calls for equality of rights for Arabs from sitting in the Knesset or being elected to it. End quote. Outright, that was a high court decision in Israel. One justice stated that a political party should be disqualified if it advocates, and I quote, a state, as all democratic states, of the totality of its citizens without any advantage to the Jewish people as such, end quote. Although they pay taxes, Palestinian citizens of Israel living in non-Jewish neighborhoods receive only a fraction of the resources and services granted to Jewish neighborhoods. Anna Balzer was a scholar and a person who personally experienced life under occupation. Even as a Jewish person, she was able to escape some of the most heinous repressions that are directed against Arab non-Jews. But even as a Jewish person, she not only witnessed these things, but she occasionally fell victim to it herself, according to my reading of this book, Witness in Palestine, which is available in podcast, chapter by chapter, journal entry by journal entry. Go to Radio for All and check it out, Witness in Palestine. And continuing here with the Israel is a democracy myth. Moreover, more than one-third of the people living under Israeli rule are denied Israeli citizenship and the rights and protections that come along with it, including the right to participate in the government that controls their lives. More than one-third of the people living under Israeli rule. These are the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The government, in which non-Jews in these areas can participate, is not allowed to do basic things like control its people's own border security or finances. That government is, of course, the Palestinian Authority. The PA would prefer to be referred to as the State of Palestine. They even officially changed their name to that, but the recognition of that moniker hasn't gotten very far, and it certainly has zero practicality in terms of achieving their sovereignty. Okay. Yes, siree. And myth number five, the return of the Palestinian refugees would mean the displacement of Jewish Israelis and is therefore impossible. Listen closely. Dr. Salman Abusita, a former member of the Palestinian National Council and the founder of the Palestine Land Society, has conducted extensive research on the possibility of refugees returning to their villages, many of which no longer exist. At an international convention on the right of return in July of 2006, he clarified his findings in five illustrative points. For anyone who's ever believed in this myth that Palestinian refugees cannot return because it would wreck Israel, listen closely. His Abusita's five illustrative points. One, the land of the refugees, roughly 93% of present-day Israel, is currently inhabited by 1.5% of Israeli Jews, only 1.5% of Israeli Jews. Point two, of the more than 500 Palestinian villages from which the refugees were expelled, 90% are still vacant, which is to say many planted over with trees. 7% are partially built over, and just 3% are completely built over, those in Tel Aviv and West Jerusalem. Point three, a full 97% of Palestinian refugees live within 62 miles of their homes, and 50% of them live within 25 miles. Many can see their land from their camps but cannot go there. Number four, the population density of Gaza is roughly 15,500 people per square mile, density in Gaza, while Gaza's refugees' land nearby is practically empty, fewer than 16 Israelis per square mile, 15,500 Arabs per square mile in Gaza compared to 16, just 16, 1/6 Israelis per square mile in their former homes. There are fewer Jews in the half of Israel closest to Gaza, from Ramleh to Eilat, than the population of a single Gaza refugee camp. Israel has welcomed as many Russian immigrants as there are Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Gaza combined, and has been clear that it would make room for millions more Jewish immigrants if such a possibility arose. It's 4 p.m., 1600 hours, this Monday, August 3rd, 2015. How about some more lovely Arab-American music that I have treated you before to, treated to you before on this program, from Rounder Records, a retrospective collection, the music of Arab Americans.
Thank you. اسطوانات نجمة الشرق الأستاذ رزق الله البني.
طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي صرت أحسب أرقامي صرت أحسب أرقامي وحسابي رح عبي الكيل وحسابي رح عبي الكيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل
بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان والسابق واحد نعسان والسابق واحد نعسان كان ماشي ومقطوع الحيل كان ماشي ومقطوع الحيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
كان معي مال بحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح كان معي مال بحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح وما تغمض جفني بالليل ما تغمض جفني بالليل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل
مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين كل خسارة عالحالين كل خسارة عالحالين حالتنا صفت بالويل وحالتنا صفت بالويل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
في مرة طلعت من البيت واعد مرتي جبلة زيت في مرة طلعت من البيت واعد مرتي جبلة زيت من دربة رحت تخبيت من دربة رحت تخبيت المصاري طاروا على الخيل المصاري طاروا على الخيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل
قالت قالت لدنقنا من البرد من الأمطار وكتر الشرد قالت لدنقنا من البرد من الأمطار وكتر الشرد وإن كنت مخبى يا قرد وإن كنت مخبى يا قرد وزهر كنت زاير الخيل بيظهر كنت زاير الخيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير علي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير علي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير علي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير علي وهد الخيل
And once again, you were listening to the album, digital album here, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, specifically, flute imitation. Oh, a little commotion going on here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Comes with the territory, folks. Here, hey, let me go close the door, okay? Bless it. Yeah, that's me cursing and swearing in the background. Things that one occasionally has to put up with. And in any workplace scenario, obviously, or play place, or school, church, wherever you happen to be. This is the Mideast Migraines program, folks, perhaps to no one's surprise, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's 4:12 in the afternoon, Monday, August 3rd. I'm your host, Ren Tawil, Palestinian-American. Okay, and again from the album, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, Flute Imitation was the first item. That last thing you were listening to, I think it has to do with betting on horses. Alib al-Khayl, Alib al-Khayl. I was just talking to one of our next programmers this evening and explaining that even though the album contains music of Arab Americans, most likely the majority, most or all of the people featured singing and playing are from the old countries, and the recordings most likely occurred on our own shores, in our own northwestern hemisphere. Okay. Now, I think we've ready to get back to our very important work here. Just finished talking about this nonsense in the form of a myth that says the return of Palestinian Arab refugees would mean the displacement of Jewish Israelis and is therefore impossible. Both of those statements are false. It's not true that they couldn't return and would displace next to nobody. And she ends that series of researched arguments with this statement. The issue is not about space for Jews. It is about demographics and ideology. The issue is that allowing Palestinian refugees to return would alter the ethnic character of Israel. That's most likely true. Here, before I continue and read the rest of these, let me give out the phone numbers. I just realized I haven't even given out the phone numbers yet. The phone numbers to the studio are, they do appear on our website. Click the contact link on our website. Click contact and you'll see at least one of those phone numbers. In fact, I'm always seeing it's either one or two phone numbers. Let me take a close look here. Indeed. Okay, I click on contact. There is one studio line mentioned. From my vantage point, it's one of two. Two live lines. They're both functioning and open. Area code here in Santa Cruz County, California, on the Central Coast, is 831. Area code for both phone numbers is 831. Line number one is 427-3772. Again, 831. 427-3772. And if by some peculiar miracle that line is too busy, you can call us. Or if you just feel better about trying another line, call me on line number two, 831-469-3119. Line number two is 469-3119. And the fact that I gave you the area code indicates that these are not 800 or otherwise toll-free numbers. You will have to pay both ways if you're using a cell phone, from what I understand. But that's... why am I being so negative about stuff like that? Okay. Again, those are the phone numbers you may call at your own convenience, for any reason, even if you have questions about Free Radio Santa Cruz's impending move. In the meantime, I'll just keep reading this from Anna Balzer's book, the full title of which, Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories. That Jewish-American author is Anna Balzer, who's still very much on the front lines of seeking justice for all in Palestine and Israel. Myth number six, according to Ms. Balzer. Myth number six. Israel has... forgive me. Israel has no genuine partner for negotiations or peace. Her answer to that is this. The most common example cited as, quote, proof that Palestinians do not want peace is Yasser Arafat's rejection of the offer presented by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, at Camp David in 2000. Widely perceived as generous, in fact, the proposal fell far short of Israel's responsibilities to the Palestinians under international law in numerous ways. The proposal, Barak's proposal, Israel's proposal to Arafat, would have meant, for one thing, that Israel would not withdraw from the 1967 occupied territories as required by international law. Settlements and Jewish-only roads would remain in the Palestinian state, and Israel would annex 10% of the West Bank, home to more than 80,000 Palestinians. It also would have meant that the annexed land would include some of the West Bank's most resource-rich areas. Palestinians would have limited control over their own water resources. The proposal also would have meant that Israel would maintain military control over the Jordan Valley, the West Bank's eastern border. That's actually Palestine's border with the state of Jordan, the country, the nation of Jordan. That's how far-reaching Israel's military control is and would remain, according to this proposal. She says here, the Palestinian state would be divided into three separate cantons, the Gaza Strip and the northern and southern portions of the West Bank, thereby creating a de facto archipelago of Palestinian islands within Israel, within a post-accepted proposal Israel. The proposal would also have meant that the proposal offered the Palestinians control over certain sections of Jerusalem, but kept all of the city, as well as 85.3% of settlers, under Israeli sovereignty. And the proposal denied Palestinian refugees, the majority of the Palestinian people, their inalienable right to return to their homes and lands. According to the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights, 2002. Arafat's rejection of Ehud Barak's offer does not seem so shocking when you see a map of what the final effect would have looked like. President Jimmy Carter writes about Camp David, quote, there was no possibility that any Palestinian leader could accept such terms and survive. But official statements from Washington and Jerusalem were successful in placing the entire onus for the failure on Yasser Arafat, end quote. Again, that's a quotation from Jimmy Carter in his book, most likely the book entitled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. It must be that book. It's funny it doesn't mention which book here. And even Barack's foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, a key player at Camp David, later admitted publicly, quote, "If I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well." In fact, Israel has been offered peace in exchange for compliance with international law several times and rejected each offer. Here are some examples. In the mid-1970s, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and I believe the proper name for that would be the Palestine Liberation Organization, endorsed a comprehensive peace with Israel in exchange for its full withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza. Mid-1970s, Israel rejected the offer. In March 2002, Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah, along with all 21 other members of the Arab League, proposed not only peace but normal relations and regional integration with Israel in exchange for an end to the occupation and a, quote, just solution to the refugee problem. Israel rejected the offer. Israel effectively rejected the Saudi initiative a second time when the proposal was included as part of the roadmap, quote unquote, announced by the United Nations, wrote Carter. The Palestinians accepted the roadmap in its entirety, but the Israeli government announced 14 caveats and prerequisites, some of which would preclude any final peace talks. Shortly after being elected to power in 2006, Hamas also announced its willingness to establish peace with Israel along its internationally recognized borders. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh told Newsweek and the Washington Post, quote, "If Israel withdraws the 1967 borders, then we will establish a peace in stages. We will establish a situation of stability and calm which will bring safety for our people, a long-term hudna or ceasefire," end quote. Israel has refused to negotiate with the democratically elected Palestinian government of Hamas for three official reasons. One, failure to renounce violence. Two, failure to recognize and abide by previous agreements. And three, failure to recognize the right of a state besides one of its own to exist in historic Palestine. Interestingly, Israel is guilty of all three of the very things for which it faults Hamas. It's 4:22 in the afternoon here this Monday, August 3rd. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, 2007, I think I said. It was copyright 2007. Myth number 7. Palestinian textbooks incite hatred against the Jewish people. Balzer's reply. There is a widely held belief that Palestinian textbooks demonize Israelis and teach Palestinian children to hate Jews. This particular myth originated with Itamar Marcus, an Israeli settler who founded an organization called the Center for Monitoring the Impact of Peace. Marcus's claims have been refuted by Palestinians, Israeli, American, and European studies that examine the actual content of Palestinian texts. In response to pressure from Congress, the U.S. Congress, to investigate the issue, the U.S. government commissioned the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information to convene a team of professional educators, Israeli, Palestinian, and American, to explore the allegations. Their 2003 report concluded, quote, "The Palestinian textbooks do not incite against Israel or against peace," and, quote, "the overall orientation of the curriculum is peaceful despite the harsh and violent realities on the ground. Religious and political tolerance is emphasized," end quote, talking about the school books that are given to little Palestinian children, non-Jewish children, to read in school. To do their homework with. Balcher continues, "In Europe, the prestigious Georg Eckert Institute for International Textbook Research facilitated research into the allegations. The Hebrew University's Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Achievement of Peace and the Palestine-Israel Journal of Politics, Economics, and Culture have published studies on these texts. Committees of the U.S. Senate and the European Parliament have both held hearings on the matter. It seems that no people's textbooks have been subjected to so much scrutiny as those of the Palestinians. Time and time again, independently of one another, researchers have found no incitement to hatred in Palestinian textbooks. It seems the original allegations were based on Egyptian or Jordanian textbooks and false translations." A Middle East working group of the European Union found the textbooks, and I quote, "free of insightful content, constituting a valuable contribution to the education of young Palestinians." Let me point out, as I had many, many times in the course of reading this whole book on the air, in addition to the many individuals and working groups, committees, etc., that Balcher mentions to back up her claims, there are many, many, many footnotes with many items in small print at the bottom of each page. Very well researched. Continuing with dealing with this myth that Palestinian textbooks incite hatred against the Jewish people. She says, "If anyone's textbooks deserve scrutiny, perhaps it's those of the Israelis. Professor Dan Beltar," check that, "Professor Dan Bartal, of Tel Aviv University concluded from a study of 124 Israeli textbooks that," and I quote, "over the years, generations of Israeli Jews have been taught a negative and often delegitimizing view of Arabs," end quote. Bartal reported two major themes of Arab characteristics. One implied a, quote, "primitiveness" and an, quote, "inferiority" in comparison to Jews. The other presented Arabs as violent, brutish, untrustworthy, cruel, fanatical, treacherous, and aggressive. That, by the way, according to Trauben, Jewish Weekly News of Northern California. What did I say earlier about Jews who are starting to stop, turn around, and take a second look at what they had been taught all of their lives and what their families and parents have been taught all their lives about the goodness of Israel and the glory of Zionism? Balcher goes on to say, in an article entitled "Learning All the Wrong Facts," Haaretz reporter Akiva Eldar cites numerous studies concluding that many Israeli textbooks not only dehumanize Arabs, but are entirely devoid of the word Palestinian. Also alien to many educational materials was the green line to distinguish Israel from the 1967 Palestinian territories. Those maps that do outline the West Bank often refer to it as Judea and Samaria, or Palestine-Eretz Israel, which is to say part of the, quote, "land of Israel." Some official maps in Israeli textbooks include Israeli settlements, but they exclude Palestinian towns, even those within Israel. which is to say Palestinian majority towns within the state of Israel. From Haaretz. One more myth that Anna Balzer deals with here, myth number 8. Israel only uses violence as a last resort to defend itself and to prevent terror attacks. Her response? Human rights organizations have documented extensive, disproportionate, and indiscriminate use of force by the Israeli army over 40 years. For example, according to Amnesty International, most of the children killed by soldiers in 2002 were attacked, quote, when there was no exchange of fire and in circumstances in which the lives of the soldiers were not at risk, end quote. B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, described the situation as follows. In every city and refugee camp that they have entered, IDF, or Israel Defense Forces, they call themselves Defense Forces, IDF soldiers have repeated the same pattern. Indiscriminate firing and then killing of innocent civilians. Indiscriminate firing and then killing of innocent civilians. Intentional harm to water, electricity, and telephone infrastructure. Taking over civilian houses, extensive damage to civilian property, shooting at ambulances, and prevention of medical care to the injured. End of that quotation from B'Tselem, which is from A Deadly Pattern, B'Tselem Press, March 12, 2002. Israel also uses, Balzer goes on to say here, humiliation tactics, as in the town of Halhul, where town notables and other men were taken from their homes to the town square by soldiers in the middle of the night, where they were, and I quote, ordered to urinate and defecate on one another, and also to sing Hativka, the hope, the national anthem of Israel, and to call out, long live the state of Israel. Some were even ordered to lick the earth, end quote. Other Palestinian detainees and civilians have reported being forced to crawl on all fours and bark like dogs. That is probably the oldest example of humiliating treatment of Palestinians that I can recall. I think I read it in Time magazine about 30 or 40 years ago. She goes on to say, children were made to slap their parents. Soldiers wrote numbers on the arms of Palestinian prisoners on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Israeli settlers reportedly, quote, caught an old man who had protested when his lands were taken and shaved off his beard. Just what Polish anti-Semites did to Jews. And many, many footnotes. Numbers and their corresponding footnotes. That information, some of that information anyway, is from Al-Hamishmar, February 1982, cited in Chomsky, Fateful, page 142, and also quoted Zvi Barel in Haaretz, Edward Walsh, Washington Post. It's tons of people are witness to these or used as resources. And if you don't want to believe any of them, you can go to Breaking the Silence. Google Breaking the Silence and hear the stories from disgruntled and disenchanted former Israeli soldiers themselves who for a while now, for a few years now, have started to come out and admit these crimes themselves to the world. Breaking the Silence. It's 4:33. I'm just going to continue. That is the list of Balzer's 8 myths regarding Israel and Palestine. If anyone wants to call in and talk. You still got time to call in here. Line number one, area code 831-427-3772. That's the number that appears on our website, 427-3772. Line number two, 469-3119. 469-3119. Just a quick reminder, the word is out that Free Radio Santa Cruz needs to vacate the premises where it currently keeps its broadcasting studio. We have to be out by the first day of October of this year. We received notice just yesterday. As we like to say it, we've lost our lease. The property and the owners and the residents of the place where we have the studio is in the throes of its own internal and legal upheaval. And unfortunately, one of the results of that is the fact that we need to leave in 2 months. Now, I'm going to continue to read from Balzer's one of the appendices in her book, Witness in Palestine. Those are the myths, the eight myths. Now, these are a list of frequently asked questions. Five FAQs, frequently asked questions. Number one, lots of countries are violating human rights. Why single Israel out? It is successive U.S. governments that have consistently singled Israel out. Israel has unconditionally received more U.S. economic and military aid than any other country in the world. U.S. taxpayers should be particularly concerned by the atrocities they are subsidizing. The U.S. government also perpetuates the conflict by preventing the United Nations from taking decisive action against Israel's crimes. A University of Cambridge study found that the U.S. veto has ensured that Israel enjoys, quote, virtual immunity from the enforcement of measures typically adopted by the U.N. against countries committing identical violations of international law. According to President Carter, the United States has used its U.N. Security Council veto more than 40 times to block resolutions critical of Israel. Some of these vetoes have brought international discredit on the United States, and there is little doubt that the lack of a persistent effort to resolve the Palestinian issue is a major source of anti-American sentiment and terrorist activity throughout the Middle East and the Islamic world. In other words, dear listener, it can be reasonably and forcefully argued that the existence and the policies and actions of the state of Israel, which is supposed to be our number one major, even exclusive ally, some would say, in the Middle East, are the reasons why Israel has fallen into that position as being seen our ally. If it weren't for the things that Israel does to its own Palestinians and to its Arab national neighbors, Arab-controlled countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Syria. If it weren't attacking those countries, then there would be considerably less anti-American sentiment and less terrorist activity. Possibly no 9/11. But that really is another story. Anyone who listens to my Saturday broadcast of Mideast Migraines at 11 a.m. know exactly what I'm talking about. At any rate, yeah, that end of quotation from President Carter. Of course, Balzer goes on to say, of course, opposing Israeli atrocities in Palestine is part of a larger commitment to global justice and anti-racism. Moral consistency requires that we stand vigilant against injustice no matter where it happens, no matter who the victim. Sadly, this question is often used not to highlight other just freedom struggles, but to deflect criticism away from Israel, which has violated more UN resolutions than any other country in the history of the United Nations. Whereas other countries are routinely punished for their transgressions, Israel is not. The question is not whether Israel should be singled out for criticism, but rather whether it should be held at the same standard as other countries, or singled out for impunity. Impunity means inability to punish someone, or inability to be punished. Frequently asked question number two. Why place so much blame on Israel when Arab countries have also abused Palestinians? Balcher's answer, some Arab countries, such as Lebanon, have a terrible record with regard to Palestinian rights. Others, like Syria and Jordan, have been more welcoming to Palestinians, though grievances remain. It is inaccurate to group all Arab countries together. The fact that Palestinians have not always been welcomed by other countries does not in any way absolve Israel of its responsibility in having forced Palestinians into exile and prevented them from returning to this day. To offer an analogy, nobody would ever claim that since Jews were persecuted and rejected as they fled Europe during World War II, Germany should not be faulted for having caused them to flee. In fact, the world's reluctance to protect Jewish refugees rendered Germany's actions all the more reprehensible. Frequently asked question number three. Why don't many Palestinians recognize Israel's right to exist? Here's Balcher's answer. Historically speaking, Fatah already recognized Israel's right to exist in 1988. Today, Hamas has implicitly agreed to recognize Israel in a long-term ceasefire, even if they do not think it has a right. She italicizes the word right here. Even if they do not think it has a right to exclude Palestinians. It is, in fact, Israel that does not recognize Palestine's right to exist. For example, Likud, a prominent Israeli political party, specifically bars the existence of a Palestinian state. If recognition is a precondition, why does the international community not hold Israel to the same standard before lending its support? Also, as President Carter has put it, quote, what Israel? End quote. What Israel? Israel has never officially defined its own borders. They expand over time. Does, quote, Israel mean the 1947 borders or the 1967 borders? Or the borders today encompassing virtually all of historic Palestine? Or does it mean any Israel, no matter how far it goes in the future? How can Palestinians recognize the right of a state perpetually displacing them? How can Palestinians recognize the right of a state perpetually displacing them? The bottom line is that in order to create and maintain a Jewish state with a Jewish majority, it has been necessary to forcibly expel almost all non-Jews from the area and continuously discriminate against them. Palestinians are being asked, do you recognize the right for there to be a state on your historic homeland that explicitly excludes you, your family, and your people? What would your own answer be to that question? FAQ number four, why does the U.S. continue to give Israel so much aid and political support? There is a lot of debate about why the U.S. supports Israel as much as it does. The different theories can be summed up as follows. Number one, pay close attention, dear listener. One of the most powerful lobbies in the U.S. is the, quote, Zionist lobby or, quote, Israel lobby. incidentally, often mislabeled the Jewish lobby, even though it is composed of many non-Jews and many Jews oppose it, led by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Described in the New York Times as, quote, the most important organization affecting America's relationship with Israel. AIPAC has more than 100,000 U.S. members and an annual budget of as much as $40 million, which it uses to promote U.S. policy aligned with Israeli interests. AIPAC has successfully defeated numerous senators who were perceived to be insufficiently pro-Israel. That fact is taken from Mitchell Cady. Tiny Israel's giant U.S. lobby goes unmentioned in campaign finance hearings. Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, December 1997, page 42. Balcher continues, University of Chicago professor John Mearsheimer and Harvard professor Stephen Walt published a controversial piece entitled, entitled The Israel Lobby, outlining various ways in which the lobby's control over U.S. politics actually functions to the detriment of U.S. strategic interests. Possible reason number two as to why does the U.S. continue to give Israel so much aid and political support. Some argue that the U.S. would never pursue another country's interest above its own, and that U.S. support for Israel is due to the country's twin interests in military and spin-off development projects and the storage and base facilities that Israel provides for U.S. forces targeting oil-rich countries in the region. Still others believe that it is a combination of the Zionist lobby and U.S. strategic interests that perpetuates U.S. support for Israeli violations of international law. Possible reason number three, why we support Israel. No small number of American industries are profiting from U.S. support for Israel. Most notable among these are U.S. arms manufacturers. In addition to American weapons that are donated to Israel, at least two-thirds of U.S. financial aid to Israel is earmarked for purchase of more U.S. arms. So our money goes to Israel, and some of that is used to purchase arms from U.S. arms industries. Other groups profiting from the conflict include the oil industry, Arab leaders, and U.S. elected representatives who receive generous election donations for maintaining the status quo or increasing U.S. unconditional support for Israel. Possible reason number four. Finally, American public opinion tends to be sympathetic towards Israel for two reasons. First, people are understandably sensitive to the plight of Jews throughout history. Against this historic backdrop, people are resistant to criticizing Israel and seeing Jews as anything other than the victims. Second, although American taxpayers give more foreign aid to Israel than to any other country in the world, many remain largely ignorant of the uses of this aid and therefore do nothing to change it. This is due in large part to what many, myself included, perceive, and this, of course, is the words of author Anna Balcher, this is due in large part to what many, myself included, perceived as a U.S. mainstream media pro-Israel bias, which is documented extensively by the organization If Americans Knew. One of the group's studies found that the Associated Press reported deaths of Israeli children even more often than they occurred, but failed to cover 85% of the deaths of Palestinian children. Another study on the San Francisco Chronicle made 30 mentions of Israeli children dying for every 20 who died, which is to say some deaths were reported more than once. But the Chronicle reported on only 1 in 20 deaths of Palestinian children. Studies on the New York Times, ABC, CBS, NBC, and other media sources revealed similar trends. Stories about torture, hunger strikes, Israeli refuseniks, and Palestinian popular resistance were also grossly underreported. And she's talking here, most likely, when she mentions the hunger strikes, that would be strikes, hunger strikes among Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, including many children. And the Palestinian popular resistance refers, in most cases, to a nonviolent resistance, projects, creative resistance, etc. As long as, she says here, as long as Americans remain ignorant of Israel's atrocities, they are unlikely to pressure their government to stop funding them. Finally, frequently asked question number 5 that Anna Balzer is dealing with here. Shouldn't people remain balanced and not take sides on a controversial and divisive issue like Israel and Palestine? Here's what Balzer has to say about that. South African anti-apartheid leader Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor." There have been times in history when remaining neutral was the wrong thing to do. In fact, it is what has enabled grotesque human rights violations to continue. It is always good to hear different perspectives, but once certain injustices have become clear, it is appropriate to take a side. Not for or against any particular religious or ethnic group, but for justice and against, for justice and against discrimination. In this way, we can be proudly one-sided, pro-equality and anti-oppression. I really like this woman. Okay, we got through all of Balzer's myths and FAQs. She has another appendix here, appendix number 5, quotations from prominent figures. I think I began reading some of those. I may just read them to you again on a future show. An important glossary. And wonderful book, which is available from Paradigm Press. Paradigm, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M, ParadigmPress.com. It's ParadigmPublishers.com, ParadigmPublishers.com. The book is entitled The Witness in Palestine by Anna Balzer. Okay, folks. It's getting close to for me to hang up the mic. Again, my name is Lawrence Tweel. I go by the diminutive first name of Wren, R-E-N. I was born in San Francisco, California. My father was born and bred, along with his whole family, in Jerusalem and Palestine. He, as were all his siblings and parents, born before the creation of the modern state of Israel over there. Now, to repeat, it is critical that people understand that Free Radio Santa Cruz, in one form or another, intends to stay on the air from now until forever. But we do have to vacate the studio in 2 months' time. Just as a general spot on the calendar to pinpoint, October 1st, gives us a time frame that we need to locate a new location for the studio. Whoever chooses to make this new property available to us obviously has to fully understand the implications of housing a non-licensed radio service, community pirate radio station. It's obviously can be done because it's being done as I speak. And we've been in business, if you want to call it a business, for 20 years now, over 20 years. March, our birthday was in March. We do indeedy look forward to, I'm trying to do two things at once here. To hearing from you, and you can expect to be hearing more and more about the current crisis status of free radio, as we just, as it is only 24 hours old in terms of when we were notified of the situation. So, thank you again. Tune in next Monday at 3 p.m. when hopefully I'll have some recent news from Palestine and Israel. And tune in to the concluding chapters of Christopher Bolin's Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. That'll be on the Saturday 11 a.m. edition of Mideast Migraines. Thanks, and ta-ta.
المطربة المحبوبة كهرمان
Only you اللي بحبه Only you اللي بريده Only you انت حبيبي Only you انت نصيبي